Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, Valley Fever. Why is this deadly disease still going misdiagnosed, and why it poses such a risk to Valley residents? We begin an in-depth look at a disease that has reached epidemic levels. Also, unemployment in the inner city, how the Black Chamber of Commerce is working to put people back to work. Plus, Sierra Art Trails prepares for its 10th anniversary. But first, it is a disease that you are more likely to be diagnosed with than hantavirus, hepatitis A, whooping cough, even salmonella poisoning. Yet the average person knows so little about it. It's called Valley Fever and is very prevalent here in the Central Valley. To bring awareness about this deadly disease, a group of reporters have come together in a collaborative effort to inform and engage the public. Before we begin our discussion, we have this report from KBPR's Joe Moore.
Here in California's San Joaquin Valley, the disease known as Valley Fever can strike anyone at almost any time. Just ask Dr. James McCarthy.
No, it's pretty difficult to prevent something that you can acquire just by breathing in the air.
Air that contains the spores of a soil fungus found throughout much of the Southwest, but especially in the southern portions of the San Joaquin Valley. Dr. McCarthy is a pediatric infectious disease specialist at Children's Hospital Central California in Madera. He is on the front lines of battling the disease that sickens as many as 150,000 in the U.S. every year and is responsible for as many as 100 deaths annually across the country. That's more deaths than salmonella, hantavirus, and whooping cough combined. Since 1995, reported cases of the disease have risen 12-fold, leading some to call it an epidemic. And according to Dr. McCarthy, many cases of the disease go overlooked or misdiagnosed.
A delay in diagnosis can sometimes mean the difference between a moderate illness and a severe illness. So it's important that doctors or clinicians in the San Joaquin Valley, and particularly in the South Valley, when they have patients with pneumonia, that they always think about Valley Fever, and when they have patients that have prolonged and unexplained illnesses, that they also think about Valley Fever.
If people inhale the spores of the fungus, they can grow inside the lungs, resulting in a fever, persistent cough, and night sweats.
Many of those patients, or if not most, will get over this on their own. And then a small percentage, about 5% of people that get Valley Fever, will get pneumonia, and this can range anywhere from mild to moderate to severe.
But if left unchecked, the consequences of the disease can be much worse.
About 1 out of 100 people that get Valley Fever, it will spread outside of the lungs and go to other parts of the body. And when it does that, it usually goes to the brain or to the bones or to the skin.
African Americans and Filipino Americans are two groups that are most at risk, as well as those with weakened immune systems and women in the third trimester of pregnancy. And while medication can help treat the disease, there is no cure. And research into a possible vaccine has stalled due to a lack of funding. As part of the Reporting on Health Collaborative, reporter Rebecca Plevin talked with several South Valley residents who have had their lives touched by the disease. Monica Blake's son, Tyler Bridgewater, died from the disease after it spread to his brain.
He was Little Mr. Athlete, played football, never sick, never anything. He didn't go to the doctor unless he was going for sports physicals. And then he was slammed by this. He was 12. He passed away a little over a month before he would have been 13.
She says it took doctors too long to point to Valley Fever as the cause of his illness, even after he was discharged from the hospital in Bakersfield.
They diagnosed him with meningitis, and then when he was rushed back in the ambulance, they diagnosed it as encephalitis, but never once did they test for Valley Fever.
Rob Purdy spent 5 weeks in the hospital trying to beat his case of Valley Fever.
Born and raised in Bakersfield, everybody's familiar with Valley Fever. Wasn't familiar with it being anything other than something that occurred in the lungs. certainly wasn't familiar with being a form of meningitis, and surprised to learn that I was going to have to deal with it for the rest of my life.
Paula Einstein is the daughter of one of the doctors who helped lead research into valley fever for years in Kern County, and she too contracted the disease.
People always say, once you get it, you're immune. You're not really immune. It's in your system, kind of the way chicken pox can turn to shingles sometimes. It's sort of a rough analogy, but it's with you. And if you get compromised, if your immune system gets compromised, some people get something else, and then they find out they had it all along. They never knew.
It's a disease that has touched many here in Central California and will continue to do so. But with greater attention and awareness, the hope for better treatment and perhaps even a cure remains. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
Joining us now is Rebecca Plevin, a reporter with Vida en el Valle. That's the Fresno Bee Spanish language newspaper. We will also be joined a little later by Dr. John Galgiani, director of Valley Fever Center for Excellence at the University of Arizona, and Kurt Emery, Kern County Public Health Services Department. But we will start with Rebecca. Rebecca, how and why did this group of reporters come together, and why did they focus on Valley Fever?
Thanks. So I'm part of a team of reporters. It's also from Vida en el Valle, from the Bakersfield Californian, the Merced Sun Star, the Stockton Record, and the Voice of OC in Orange County. And we were looking to do a series of stories that both impacted people throughout the San Joaquin Valley and beyond. And Valley Fever seemed like a great choice because it's something that impacts all of us. And then as we started looking into it, we learned more about how it's overlooked, underfunded, and the cases are only increasing.
Why do you feel it's important? In a way, like you talk about, those of us who grew up in the Valley, we've heard of Valley Fever. We probably know of someone who's had Valley Fever. But yet, as you mentioned, we've made so little progress. So why do you think it's important then just really to focus on this and kind of hammer it home to people?
Yeah, it's really important to raise awareness of Valley Fever. We've learned that when patients are aware of Valley Fever, they're twice as likely to ask to be tested for it. When doctors are and the medical community are aware of it, they're more likely to test for it and avoid, giving people antibiotics that will do nothing against the fungus, avoid unnecessary surgeries, and avoid that stress that comes when people don't know what's wrong with them. We also avoid the extra costs of people who get very sick and miss school and work and can't do the things that they love to do.
And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the people in your stories, but also at this time, we would like to invite our listeners to join us in the conversation. As we mentioned, if you grew up in the Valley, you know someone, or maybe you've had Valley Fever, we'd like for you to call in and share your stories with us. You can call in at these numbers, 800-224-8989, or 559-275-8989, or you can email us at talk@kbpr.org. We'd like to hear your stories, and we'd like for you to join us in this discussion. I think we already have someone on the line. Sharon.
Hello. Yes, hi.
Hi. You say you are or were a Valley Fever victim or was diagnosed?
Yes, I have Valley Fever in 2001, and I almost died from it, had a near-death experience with it, and I still have problems from it.
Now,
and
did you grow up in the...
that occurring, we started to look more and more into Valley Fever in our family, and my son and I started ValleyFeverSurvivor.com, which is a organization that is renowned now because it's been 10 years. It's renowned for being the number one public place to go if you have for support of Valley Fever victims.
Now, did you grow up in the Valley?
No, I did not. I did not. My particular case actually did not occur in California, but we know thousands and thousands and thousands of people from California who have contracted it. we have been keeping statistics now for all these years, and we have tons of information that generally is not reported by doctors who are out there trying to take care of people with Valley fever, or most of the media, which never gets the information, the current information that's there either. For instance, we have found that there's for 2011 in the United States, there were 22,634 cases that were reported to the CDC. And when you multiply that out using the CDC's own formula, which they had started doing many, many years ago, that only 2% of cases are ever identified accurately, leaving 98% unidentified or misdiagnosed. The actual number for 2011 is a horrifying 1,131,700 estimated infections for 2011 throughout the United States.
Well, you know, thank you, Sharon. And I think that is one of the things that we hear and we want to talk about, Rebecca, if you can address that, is that keeping records, keeping statistics, that hasn't happened with Valley fever. And why is that?
It's a disease, like Sharon said, is proved really hard to track, I think, for those reasons that it's often misdiagnosed. And there's been different ways that that California and Arizona have tracked this disease. And I know that both Dr. Galgiani and Kurt Emery can really address that later on as well.
Yes, and especially thank you, Sharon. We're going to move on. Now, Dr. Galgiani, if I understand, you're there with us. Now, at the University of Arizona, where you have set up a center, what are you trying to do there? Because of what we've talked about and the fact that records aren't being kept the way they should, and just this whole awareness about Valley fever.
Hi. Yeah. Thank you, Anita. We started the Valley Fever Center for Excellence at the University of Arizona in 1996, and so we've been trying to, just like you're doing on this program, first raise awareness and education both in the general public and also in the professional community, but also then to stimulate research for better ways of diagnosing the disease, new treatments, possibly cures, and eventually, hopefully, a vaccine to completely eliminate this problem.
And Mr. Emery, I mean, you're in Kern County, so many cases in Kern County. What has the county been able to do when it comes to record keeping and education just because of the cases you have there?
Well, you know, we obviously have to rely on healthcare providers to send us reports to get much of our information, but because we've had a laboratory or a couple laboratories that do the majority of testing for individuals for Valley fever, our numbers are fairly good and fairly consistent over the years and decades for, you know, what we've experienced in Kern County. We're also working to excite the epidemiologists up and down the Central Valley to start capturing similar consistent data and working with the state to also get it involved with some of the newer web-based reporting systems so, you know, across California we can capture the information more consistently.
And I noticed, you know, I heard both of you mention what you're doing starting in the 1990s. Why did it take us so long to start these projects when Valley fever has been around forever, it seems?
Well, if you'd like me to, I have some thoughts about that.
Is this Dr. Galgiani?
This is Dr. Galgiani, yes. Actually, if you look at the area that's the most intensely endemic for this fungal infection, until not so long ago, this was pretty rural country. It was the Central Valley of California. The south-central Sonoran deserts of Arizona are the major areas where this fungus is found. And it was really a disease of a very sparse population. And it's only in the last, say, three, four decades in which the population explosion around Phoenix, also the growth in communities up and down the Central Valley of California, that over that period of time, the population has moved into the endemic regions. And so I think we were caught in a situation where it went from being a disease of a very small community to one now of several very large urban areas.
And we're going to get back to Rebecca and some of the interviews and stories you did, because there seemed to be a common theme going through them, and that was, why does it take so long for doctors to diagnose this, even in areas where Valley fever is very prevalent, because of the story you told of a 7-year-old Emily from Delano.
Yeah. So Emily is this delightful, spirited little girl, and she loves to dance. And last spring, she suddenly got so tired that she couldn't dance, let alone walk through the halls of her family's home. And, you know, her mom knew something was wrong and took her to the doctor, and they said, oh, it's pneumonia. And then they gave her antibiotics, which doesn't do anything for Valley fever. And then a couple of days later, she was still very sick and broke out in hives and rashes. And the doctor said, oh, it's a allergic reaction to the drugs. And her mom thought, you know, I just don't think that's it. That something is wrong. And so they finally did a test and did a biopsy. They did an x-ray of Emily's lungs and saw a white spot the size of a quarter on her lungs. And that was the telltale sign, not of pneumonia, but of Valley fever. And her mom always says now that as a parent, it's really important to push doctors, that you know your child best. And if you know something is just wrong, it's really important to push them.
Again, we'd like to invite our listeners to tell your own personal stories about Valley fever and share them with us by calling in at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989. And as we talk about personal stories, I have one to share. I was diagnosed with Valley fever when I was 4 years old. I grew up in Bakersfield, so when I read Emily's story, it so reminded me of myself being a 4-year old. I was misdiagnosed. My parents were told that I had polio. And so it does take a while. But the problem is, while you're waiting to be diagnosed, you're losing precious time. I'd like to have both of our guests, Dr. Galgiani and Mr. Emery, talk about why is it taking so long, even in areas where it's prevalent, for this disease to be diagnosed? Because you do lose precious time.
Kurt?
Well, you know, it's I guess from, you know, an epidemiologist's perspective, it's an ongoing challenge, education of healthcare providers. You know, you continually get new healthcare providers in your county, your state. Getting them up to speed is an ongoing process. The clinician's, you know, initial, you know, judgment is critical. Their understanding of, you know, how long it takes in some individuals to, you know, even present to a healthcare facility, they all impact, you know, what, you know, the time frame of diagnosis is going to be. So, again, we, you know, try to bring that awareness to our clinicians in Kern County and up and down the valley, as well as the individuals, because it's, you know, it's a two-way street. If a patient goes in and knows about a little bit about Valley fever and raises the question, that also helps in making the diagnosis quicker, because, you know, we bombard our healthcare system with a lot of things that they have to deal with, and you know, it's a challenge.
Maybe I could add to that. I agree with everything Kurt just said. In addition, many patients who have Valley fever actually have the disease eventually go away on its own, and then will be quite immune to having it recur any time in the future. And some doctors, I think, well, if we're not going to start a drug treatment for this, if it's going to slowly get better on its own, maybe we don't even need to diagnose it. But I think that's probably a mistake, because once you know what you're dealing with, it helps the patient with by putting a name on the problem that's making them so sick. And that in itself is valuable. Plus, as was pointed out earlier, you can stop doing tests and maybe even treat inappropriately for things that the patient doesn't really have. So, and also, since the complications, when they occur, tend to occur early in the course of illness, if you already have a diagnosis of valley fever, the complications are likely to be picked up much earlier. So for all those reasons, whether or not you end up actually treating a patient with an antifungal drug in the first instance, I think early diagnosis is very valuable, and we're trying to get doctors to do that more often.
Dr. Galgiani, just what you mentioned, is part of this really making doctors more aware, especially doctors who are going to be practicing in these areas where valley fever is prevalent, and just more education and awareness to the doctors themselves? Because when you have a disease where people die, it's not something where you say you can afford for it to be misdiagnosed.
Right. I think repetition is probably part of the process here. As Kurt mentioned, there's an awful lot of things for doctors to have to deal with on an ongoing basis. But if in the endemic region there's attention brought on a regular basis to valley fever, I think it just starts to become part of a reflex reaction that if somebody has pneumonia, that valley fever is one of the first things you look for.
And Rebecca, because we talked about, you know, with the little girl Emily being in Delano, Delano is an area in the Central Valley, just like Kern County and Bakersfield, where there is an awareness about valley fever. But you told another story of this very young couple, winemakers from Southern California, and moved to Paso Robles, and in 3 years, their whole life changed.
That's right. Yeah, this this couple, it's Todd Schaefer and his wife Tammy, moved to Paso Robles, and they have this winery. And one day, Todd was out there, and he was just bulldozing the soil and must have breathed in a whole lot of dirt, because a couple weeks later, he became very sick. And sort of like we've been talking about with this trend of misdiagnosis, Todd went to the hospital, and they said, oh, you know, just give him chicken soup and cranberry juice and bed rest, and he'll get better. Well, you know, of course, he didn't get better. Tammy took him back to the hospital again. Doctor sent him home. Finally, he was in Southern California. He went back to the hospital, and doctors didn't know what it was. He was put in quarantine. Then he was put in the ICU. Finally, they found out that it was valley fever, but it had moved into his it became spinal fungal meningitis, which was a very tough diagnosis for a young guy.
And he's going to be forever impacted by this.
Forever impacted. He's been on antifungal medication for almost a decade now. It's had horrible side effects. I mean, here's a winemaker. He can no longer taste his wine. But beyond that, I mean, he had a small stroke. When I spoke with him in August, he said that he had worked just 2 days in the past 6 months. I mean, it really just upended their entire lives.
Dr. Galgiani, what do we know about a better way to treat this? Because right now what they're treating it with really does have a very negative impact on the patients.
Well, fortunately, we do have treatments, and we're glad to have treatments. The original drug, which Paula's father, Hans Einstein, helped pioneer, was amphotericin B, and that was a very toxic medicine that was the only treatment available in the late 50s and into the 1960s. But more recently, azole drugs, or oral medicines that you can take by mouth, help improve things by inhibiting the fungus from growing, and that makes people feel better. But these drugs, all of them, do not actually cure the infection. And at the moment, there is no way of actually eradicating the infection if your immune system doesn't control it. There is a drug that is actually in clinical trials, was started in the 1990s, but its development went dormant because the company who was developing it went out of business in 2000. And the drug Nicomycin Z was now transferred in 2005 to the University of Arizona, and actually the school is now the sponsor of that drug at the FDA. And over the last 7 years now, clinical trials have been reinitiated through small business grants to a spin-off company and also other NIH grants to the school. The trials have begun, and we're currently trying to make more drug to continue those clinical trials. But that drug is going to require financial support either from investors or from a pharmaceutical company, because it just costs a lot of money to take a drug from where it is now on to commercialization.
And for Dr. Galgiani and Mr. Emery, why is it that Valley Fever and research for Valley Fever is just not getting the funding?
Well it's Kurt, you want to go ahead?
We'll start with you, Mr. Emery.
Okay, well, with everything, I mean, you know, it's an economic challenge for, you know, many of, you know, the pharmaceutical products that are produced, and, you know, the reality is you know, Valley Fever or coccidioidomycosis has been in these selected areas for a long time, but, you know, you have to be able to produce it and be survivable as a pharmaceutical company or the person who's manufacturing it. It really has to have that, and I think that's one of the biggest challenges that face, you know, this disease and getting better treatments and vaccine at this point.
Another way to put that is that Valley Fever is considered an orphan disease. The term orphan disease was created by the FDA to define any disease that's less than 200,000 prevalence. And Valley Fever actually is inside that envelope. But what's unusual about this is that it's so concentrated into such small geographic areas that for the areas of Bakersfield and the Central Valley of California and Phoenix and Tucson, it's anything but an orphan disease. It's actually the second most commonly reported disease to the Department of Health Services in Arizona on their list of reportable diseases. So it's a very important problem to those regions. And I think it's those people within the regions who need to make their needs heard, because if those populations aren't aware of this problem and, you know, sort of committed to trying to improve our responses to that, I don't think it's going to be, there aren't going to be other better advocates anywhere else in the country.
And we're going to talk a little bit about just Valley Fever itself for people who may not be as familiar with it. But before we go into that discussion, I just want to remind our listeners that you can read Rebecca's reports and all of the coverage from the other reporters who participated in this project, Just One Breath. They're all on our website at kbpr.org. Now, again, let's talk a little bit about this disease itself. What are the symptoms? Who wants to answer that one? Dr. Galgiani?
Well, for most people, the symptoms are that of a community-acquired pneumonia. Their respiratory symptoms like chest pain, cough, night sweats, a doctor would say you have pneumonia. And many places around the country, the appropriate response would be to start an antibacterial agent. But in studies done in Phoenix and Tucson, if you have that syndrome, one time out of three, that's due to the fungus that causes Valley Fever, not a bacteria. But there are quite a few other kinds of things, but the most common is that of a respiratory illness.
They also list weight loss and rashes, so all those things people need to be aware of. Now, how is this commonly diagnosed? What is the way most doctors diagnose this?
Kurt, why don't you take that?
Okay. Well, there are blood tests available that have been used for years and years and years. And when you go in, your doctor can order a simple blood test and determine, you know, whether you have basically the disease or don't have the disease.
And Dr. Galgiani, I know you touched on this a little bit, but what is the best way this is treated? What drugs are being used now?
Well, for some people, actually, once the diagnosis is made, if their immune system is controlling this, it might be the best thing to do not to treat it and let your immune system do its job. But if treatment's needed, the typical treatments are oral drugs, a class called azoles, which are some of the most common ones used would be fluconazole or itraconazole. And these are tablet form or capsule form medicines, but tend to be used if needed for many months. And actually, in the complicated forms of this disease, treatment may go on for many years. And in some cases, such as those patients with meningitis, recommendations are for lifelong treatment.
And Mr. Emery, who is at most risk for valley fever?
When you say at most risk of acquiring valley fever, we're all the same. We all have to breathe in air to survive. So there is no real difference in risk in acquiring the disease. What you're listening to or have heard today is there is a difference in risk from having one of those self-contained, your body takes care of it, and moving on to a outside the lung disseminated. There are different levels of risk for the severe complicated forms of it that we have identified.
Aren't there, it's my understanding, and I've also been told this, that African Americans and Filipinos are at a higher risk, more likely to be diagnosed or contract the disease?
To have disseminated disease or severe complications. The process of inhaling the spores is going to be the same for humans, for other mammals as well. So it's the inhalation of this spore that's in the air that, and there is there really any difference between animals and humans that are breathing? And the answer is probably no. It's that other stage that once it gets in, what happens to it in the different individuals.
Okay. Rebecca, what is the goal? What are you hoping? And the collaborative that's doing this, is going to be, you know, a month-long series and effort. What are you hoping will come from this?
We're really hoping to raise awareness of the disease, as we're talking about, among residents of San Joaquin Valley and beyond, among the medical community. We would also like to be able to raise this issue among policymakers. If there are more champions out there for this disease, it could get more funding, and it could, we could be able to focus more on finding that vaccine, that solution, so that so many people aren't still getting sick and dying. And I think one way for us to really do that is to continue to have people share their own stories, because it's when people share their own stories and help put a really compelling face on this disease that I think we're going to be able to help raise that awareness and raise its presence.
Well, I'd like to thank you all for joining us this morning for this discussion. Rebecca Plevin with VIDA in El Valle, and she's one of the reporters on this effort. Dr. John Galgiani, Director of Valley Fever Center for Excellence at the University of Arizona, and Kurt Emery, Kern County Public Health Services Department. Again, the project, Just One Breath. You can read all of these reports on our website at kvpr.org. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Unemployment in our inner cities is usually twice that as the national average. The numbers for African-American youth is as high as 40%. In some cities, workforce officials say those who live in Fresno's inner city face additional challenges.
In Fresno's inner city, young African-American males struggle to find work.
It's hard because even like going to McDonald's, I'd apply to McDonald's, Taco Bell, so many people ahead of me. And there's people I've heard that work there that have, like, bachelors, and they're working at McDonald's. So I'm like, I figure, like, how am I going to get in there?
22-year-old T.J. Brown is doing volunteer work at a youth center. Although he attended Reedley College, he left without a degree and hasn't been able to find steady work.
I'll work at any place that takes me.
He also has tattoos and believes the way you dress can impact your chances of landing a job.
I was like thinking, is it my appearance? Is it I have dreads?
While African-American males between the ages of 18 to 25 suffer an unemployment rate over 30%, the unemployment rate for African-Americans as a group is the highest in the country, now at 14%.
It's disheartening.
51-year-old Debbie Ayers has been looking for full-time work for more than a year and a half. She believes education is a key factor in today's job market.
It used to be when I started working that it was the on-the-job training type of job, and you could take that experience and go anywhere, and it's no longer like that. They want you to have degrees.
It's not only education. Jeff Davis with the Workforce Investment Board's One-Stop Employment Centers says many in the inner city face other barriers like transportation and access to the internet.
A lot of our customers have very little access to the internet, having access to a computer in general, having access to information regarding the availability of jobs in Fresno, and they can come to this site for all of those services and tools.
Knowing that these individuals face some special challenges, the Fresno Metro Black Chamber of Commerce is hosting a job fair with them in mind.
Sometimes people that need some additional support, they're willing to work.
The chamber has held a series of workshops leading up to the job fair to help job seekers with their resumes and interview skills.
So these employers are coming, understanding that, you know, these aren't always going to be all the most polished individuals, but these individuals want to work. They want to, you know, be able to bring income into their families.
Now that job fair is this week, and joining me now to talk more about this report and that job fair is the president of the Fresno Metro Black Chamber of Commerce, Tate Hill, and Daryl DeShane, who is the community coordinator for the city of Fresno. Now, you heard in this report the mention of just how difficult it is for some people in the inner city. What are some of the other challenges they face? We talked about, you know, the internet, transportation. What do you see?
Well, Juanita, I believe with a lot of the young people, you know, I work with high school students, I think one of the biggest problems is understanding how to go and look for work. The understanding that there's almost like a science, you know, you have to, the way you present yourself, being prepared, understanding the employer that you're going to talk to, how you look, you know, how you dress. But, you know, another thing is interesting. I think sometimes in this age of technology with the young people, they're so used to, you know, with technology, they do a lot of their communication through texting. You know, and I think sometimes I wonder sometimes if when they go and they have to actually talk to an employer, if those, you know, they're not developing a lot of those interpersonal skills, you know, talking. They do a lot of it through the texting, so they don't have to communicate. So when it's time for them to communicate with an employer, they don't understand how. So I think helping them to understand how to go and look for work, you know, even when you go pick up an application, you know, you don't go in shorts and flip-flops or a T-shirt. You have to look presentable because that person that you're getting it from could be the person that's going to interview you when you come back.
You know, when speaking to TJ, the young man in the report, you know, that's one of the things that he brought up, that here he is standing in line. First of all, he went with some of his friends and he talked about how they were goofing off in line and that, you know, that is part of the interview. That many of them don't understand. That is part of the interview process.
Yes. I've had employers tell me, you know, when they see a group of kids come in, right away that's a mark against them because they're, you know, they're thinking, well, can you be independent if you have to come in with your friends? And then friends do tend to mess around, joke around. And even when their parents go in with the students, you know, that's a knock against them because they want the students to be able to come in and be able to be independent and get the job on their own.
Tate, with the Fresno Metro Black Chamber of Commerce, when you have the kind of unemployment rate we see with African-American males, precisely, what does that mean for a community when you have that many people out of work?
you know, those are individuals that are not able to provide for themselves or for their families, and it has an impact on our overall economy. When one segment or one population within our community is not doing well, it has an impact on everyone. And so we think it's so important for whether they be African American or otherwise to be able to have access to good jobs and to be able to be, you know, also providers for their family, and they also support the economy. Those are the people that are going to buy your products. They're going to, you know, buy your services. And when those individuals don't have those resources, it's a drain on the entire economy.
And you talked about young people, you know, being tech savvy. But the other part is you do have people who don't have access to the Internet. And we know now that so much of the job search is done online.
It is. It is. Nowadays, most employers, especially some of the larger brands, which is where a lot of students or young people or people that don't have a lot of work experience, where they will go, it requires that they, you know, submit their application online, that they have to be able to put that information online. And if they don't have access to the Internet in a way that they can do that, sometimes they have it on their smartphone. But that's not always the best way to actually do an application. It's kind of hard to do that on a smartphone.
What are you trying to accomplish with the job fair that you're having? Now, it is this Thursday at Manchester Center?
Correct. It is this Thursday at Manchester Center. It starts at 10 a.m. We recommend people get there before 10 a.m. To get there and be prepared with, you know, the resumes and so forth. What we wanted to do with this job fair was twofold. One, to provide an opportunity for individuals to find a job. We found that there were no major multi-employer job fairs in the fall, and also to provide support to small businesses that maybe don't have all the funds to do a lot of marketing for their jobs. Here's an opportunity where we bring the potential job seekers to them.
And the city's effort in this, Daryl?
We've partnered with the Fresno Metro Black Chamber of Commerce, you know, to provide any type of support we can, you know, in supplying. You know, we've done job fairs in the past. We're connected to a lot of employers from the relationships we've built. So we've reached out to those individuals, those employers, and a lot of them will be in attendance at the job fair, you know.
Now, you were saying, Tate, too, as well, when I spoke with you earlier, that, you know, the employers that are coming are aware of the people who are, that this is a job fair for people who just may not be, as you put it, sort of polished and have everything. Now, they are aware of that. What are they willing to do?
Well, you know, by them participating in this job fair, it gives those job seekers an opportunity to find out what the qualifications that they may require. It's an opportunity for them to sell themselves, to find out what jobs are available. So this is a great opportunity for those job seekers. If you're a job seeker and you're looking for employment, you want to definitely be there.
Again, what is so important for people when they do show up?
Well, one of the things, you know, I try, you know, we've done some soft skills workshops to help people get prepared. And I told the people that attended, you know, don't go to the job fair, as crazy as it sounds, looking for a job. Go looking to network, because most of the employers are not coming to hire that day. Your goal is to go there and plant that seed to where you can, your goal, and I tell them to try and meet with them after the job fair. You know, sometimes people go to a job fair thinking, I'm going to go get a job. But that's not the goal. The goal is to make that connection, because that employer may not have the job you're looking for that day, but they may have some in the future. So go there. Even if it's an employer that's online, you know, you have to apply online. A lot of people get frustrated with that. Don't get frustrated, you know. Try and give that good impression to where you can somehow set up a meeting for that with that employer after the job fair. So don't go in with the mindset, I'm going to go get a job. Go with them in the mind of networking. Networking is powerful, because that gets you beyond the job fair.
We're going to wrap up with this, but why do you think it's important and that you targeted? I know this job fair is open to anybody and everyone. First, we do want to say that. But you are trying to target a certain group to try to encourage that and bring down those unemployment numbers that we do see in the inner city, because they're often twice as high in the inner city than they are in other portions of the city.
That's definitely correct. We wanted to support our inner city urban neighborhoods where employment is extremely high. They need jobs desperately. That's where a lot of our social services are going. And so when those people get jobs, that also reduces the amount of social services that they need and our communities improve. So we want them to be there, but we want everyone to also come.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Tate Hill, President, Fresno Metro Black Chamber of Commerce, and Daryl DeShane, Community Coordinator with the City of Fresno. Remember that job fair is Thursday at Manchester Center. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Every election year, the political debate eventually turns to issues related to morality and values. On this edition of FM 89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State biology professor Madhu Kati says that this year the candidates need to show more leadership on what he calls the biggest moral crisis of our era.
As temperatures soar during this long, hot summer, more Americans may accept the reality of climate change. Yet many stoke skepticism of the scientific consensus that climate change is happening due to human actions. Must people experience heat personally to believe that the world is getting hotter? Will they swing the other way if we get an unusually cold winter because climate models predict more extremes of weather? Call it global weirding. The human mind has a tendency to extrapolate based on immediate experience and is often unable to grasp events unfolding over a much longer arc of time than our lifespans. Yet grasp such trends we must if we are to survive as a species clinging to the thin living crust of this dynamic planet that has seen far worse cataclysms in the past and may do so again in the future. We live in the Anthropocene, a new era in Earth's history where industrialized humans are a true geological force. Will we also accept planetary stewardship and begin to live in ways that minimize rather than exaggerate the fluctuations on this dynamic planet? The first step to recovery is acceptance of the problem, which in this case depends on understanding how our everyday local actions add up to long-term planetary impacts. Fortunately, we have invented a variety of methods and tools to overcome our sensory and cognitive limitations, and through science, develop a better understanding of long-term dynamics. Unfortunately, some of us would prefer to keep scientific knowledge at bay for short-term profits. Two news stories from this long, hot summer underscore the tension between these two driving forces in American public discourse. Physicist Richard Muller of Berkeley, most prominent of climate change skeptics funded by the Koch brothers, who have much invested in maintaining short-term profits through denial of long-term consequences, did a public mea culpa when his own reanalysis of climate data led him to the same conclusions as climatologists over a decade ago, that, quote, humans are almost entirely the cause, unquote, of potentially catastrophic climate change. While this illustrates how science works, by rigorously confronting hypotheses with data, it also shows the pitfalls of not trusting experts who have spent years doing exactly that. Must we remain paralyzed in inaction, or worse, persist in our fossil fuel burning habits for decades, while professional skeptics funded by vested interests keep on challenging the experts' consensus? Meanwhile, Bill McKibben, that environmentalist Cassandra who has been beating his head for decades against the wall of climate change denialism, raised a truly terrifying specter in Rolling Stone magazine about the mathematics of our dependence on fossil fuels. To sum up McKibben's meticulously detailed argument, while governments continue to fiddle on their promise to keep global temperature rise below 2 degrees Celsius, which gives us room to add no more than 565 gigatons more of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we are in fact planning to add nearly six times that amount, 2,795 gigatons. That last, truly scary number is from a new analysis accounting for all the fossil fuel reserves that are already factored into the business plans of the oil companies and national economic policies. In other words, we are already going ahead with plans to make climate change much, much worse, even as denialist skepticism keeps concern about this looming catastrophe at the bottom of the American public's priority in this election season. In this final stretch of the long presidential election cycle, when everyone is hurling charges at each other about various moral values, where is the leadership on this deepest moral crisis confronting humanity? When will we truly become better stewards of our earth? For the moral is, This is Madhusudan Katti.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. It is one of the events Foothill residents and other art lovers look forward to every year, the Sierra Art Trails in Oakhurst. The open studio tours begin next month, but right now there is a preview exhibit going on. Joining us now with more on this event is Gloria Garland with Sierra Art Trails. Thanks so much for joining us, Ms. Garland.
Hi, Juanita. Thank you for having me.
Now, this is the 10th anniversary of this event. What has kept it going and growing?
Oh, my goodness. It's so exciting. You know, it's gone by in a wink of an eye, but here we are 10 years later, and we have grown thanks to the efforts of so many wonderfully talented volunteers and wonderfully talented artists who join with us every year.
Now, how many artists are participating this year?
Oh, this year we have well over 100.
Wow. And you know what? The artwork, too, is just as varied as the artists participating.
Oh, you know, I jokingly say we've got talent under every rock up here in the foothills. We have fantastic artists here. And it's interesting, you know, over time, there have been Hollywood studio artists retire here and participate with us. We've had phenomenal potters and fabric artists and watercolorists and wood carvers, clockmakers. I mean, you name it. When you drive by on 41, you would never know that there is so much talent up here in the foothills. And we're so thrilled to bring that to the public.
It's just a wonderful venue as well. Explain the preview event to us as it relates to the actual open studio tours.
Well, the preview exhibition, which opens September 8th and it runs through October 7th, is like a showcase. So each artist brings in one exemplary piece of their work. We collect that all up at Stellar Gallery up on Highway 41 in Oakhurst. And then people can come and view. And you can pick and choose and look at pieces that you enjoy. And then while you're there, you purchase a catalog from us. And within this catalog, not only is a complete color listing of all of the artists and their locations, we have some very nicely detailed maps, and that's where the art trails comes in. And what you can do is spend a little time, mark your map, pick out what you want to see, and then go visit the artist in their home studio working environment.
I know. That's what's so great about this. It really is a wonderful event. Now, you also, during this whole event, you have a couple of awards that you give out. Tell us a little bit about the student sponsorship.
Well, you know, we are a multitasking organization, and we have several goals. You know, one, of course, is something that we've touched on just briefly already, is that we support working artists in our mountain community, and we've been developing this area as an arts destination, and that, you know, helps our local economy. But the piece that we're especially proud of is our student sponsorships and our school art programs that we donate to. Now, part of this event, we collect funding, basically, for these adventures through our art sales, our catalogs, and then at the end of the year, we find a number of students who are good performers, who want to participate, who want to grow in the field of art, and we help sponsor them. We give them a little money for art supplies. Sometimes we buy them software, things like that. And then we also mentor students. We pair a younger student with a more seasoned art professional. We help them with some of the issues around being a professional artist, like matting, framing, presenting oneself, talking to the public, how to price your art, how to value yourself as an artist. And so we do that as well. And then we also donate some money when we can to the local schools for arts programming. And, you know, that's so under strain right now with budget cuts and cutbacks.
Exactly.
And, you know, we really see the value in art education in the school. We know that, you know, kids who participate in arts programs you know, are better at decision-making, problem-solving, creative thinking, teamwork. And we also know that being involved in arts helps a lot of kids actually stay in school and graduate.
Wow. And you also give out a community award. Who's your recipient this year?
This year, I'm sure you've heard about the Mariposa Arts Council.
Yes.
Every year we give out an award called the Keeper of the Flame, and that is for an organization that has shown real dedication to supporting the arts and the community. And this year, we had nominated the Mariposa Arts Council prior to their very tragic fire. So it's a little bit of a play on words, call it the Keeper of the Flame. So this year, because their building burnt down, but this year we're calling it the Phoenix Award. And they are very happy to get it, and we're very pleased to draw attention to their situation and support them in their rebuilding phase.
Okay, again, one more time for the public. You're in your preview event right now, but the open studio tours, they begin when and how long will that go and people have the opportunity to come up?
Well, the preview exhibit is going on right now, and you can see that at any time at Stellar Gallery on Highway 41 in Oakhurst at Gallery Row. The actual Art Trails event begins on Friday, October 5th, and it runs through Sunday, October 7th.
And again, you have over 100 artists participating this year. So for folks who take part and go and just enjoy this tour, because it's really great seeing these artists in their own work environment, it's just what an opportunity and a great way to go up and support Oakhurst as well.
Well, you know, we have people who come back year after year, and we get visitors from all over the state, and we even get people from as far away as Minnesota who come on a regular basis. So our reputation has grown, and it just keeps getting better every year.
Well, it is a great event. Again, Gloria Garland, Sierra Art Trails, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.